This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome to the big picture for today on the Financial Sense News Hour. This weekend, Jim, is my 50th high school class reunion, which is why I'm in Southern California right now to attend that.
50th? Oh my God, you're an old man.
I don't tell the world about it, however, although I think I just let it slip.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but I remember Buffalo Springfield. Let's go back to that. I remember the song For What It Is Worth, and the lyrics go something like this. There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. And if you jump a line here, there's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds, getting so much resistance from behind. Of course, it was one of the protest songs from back in the early days of the war protest movement and stuff like that. But, you know, it's like deja vu. You get the same feeling because last week, remember that the markets were really surprised when the second quarter GDP numbers came in at just a little over 1% instead of the much touted and predicted 2.6%. Now, that's a real staggering difference. The economists had it wrong. The Fed had it wrong. Fed always has it wrong. And that's why I always say it's sort of spooky because they're doing our monetary policy and they keep getting everything wrong. Except their job is really not so much monetary policy as much it is managing expectations out in the market. And all of this, you know, we're sliding down into this recession. It's not being discussed in this election. Neither Mrs. Clinton nor Mr. Trump are dealing with it. But you can see we're moving into a recession and there are new factors on the playing table, but that hasn't crossed public consciousness yet.
Yeah, I think one of the big things that came out of last Friday's GDP number, besides being a big surprise to everybody in the market sort of rallying, because that would imply that the Fed is unlikely to raise rates, because up until this point, they were thinking, well, maybe there's a chance they will go in September. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. But what also happened in those numbers, John, is they revised the numbers for GDP going back 3 or 4 years. They revised Q1 back to 0.8%. So if you take, let's say, the second quarter, 1.2, the economy is cruising at 1%. Now, the Fed is still projecting that we'll hit 2.4% this year. There's no way that's going to happen. We would have to be cruising along at 3% for Q3 and Q4. And I just don't see any big drivers that are going to, push the economy at, somebody putting the foot on the accelerator to drive it at a faster pace. It's just not going to happen. But here's something, you know, when you get one number, whether it's the first quarter, everybody thought the first quarter was an aberration. And that's what made this second quarter even more significant, because everybody said, well, that was, you know, was weather, it was all the stuff that was going on. It'll get better in the second quarter. And that's why those estimates were so high at 2.6. They're still high for the third quarter and the fourth quarter. And if we watch what has happened and transpired over the last 3 or 4 years, there's a pattern. The economy picks up in the second quarter, third quarter, starts to slow down in the fourth quarter, can go negative or really slow down in the first quarter. That's been the pattern since roughly about 2012. Well, they went back, John, and they revised all the economic numbers because the information coming in now is more complete. Rather than seasonal adjusted numbers, they have actual numbers. And in 2012, the economy grew at 2.2%. In 2013, think QE, the economy only grew at 1.7%. By 2014, it was up to 2.4. In 2015, it was 2.6. So hence the big surprise here when the second quarter only came in at 1.2 and also revising the first quarter. So now you've got two quarters. I mean, if everybody was expecting the economy to pick up, well, going from 0.8% to 1.2 isn't what I call a whopping pickup. And it's certainly not going to get us to anywhere close to what the Fed or anybody else was saying. In fact, the only people that probably got this maybe partially right was the IMF, because they were worried about the U.S. economy, that it was decelerating, which it's doing. And you notice they're talking about in this election, it's been a terrible recovery, the worst since World War II, but nobody's talking the R word. And it's kind of like, oh, no, we don't want to do that. We don't want the voters to know about that.
Well, you know, there is a definite trend. I mean, you thought the economy peaked sometime last year. And if you look at the jobs numbers, the PMIs, the LEIs, all kinds of flags out there that something is going on if you're just watching, but it's a slow pickup.
Yeah, it was our view, John, that the economy peaked in the first part of 2015. And now that's been confirmed with the new numbers that came out with the release on Friday. Since the second quarter of 2015 was the high point for the economy, and it's been in a downward decelerating trend ever since then. And we already know that corporate profits peaked in 2014. So there is a new trend that is developing. If it was one quarter, you could say, okay, it was one quarter. It might have been weather. It might have been something in the market, whatever it is. But if you go back to 2015, you can see the clear slowdown every single quarter since that time. And here's the real problem that you have. As we have talked in this economic recovery, we've had economic shocks. We had an economic shock in 2011. That was probably the big one, where you had Fukushima, you had the Arab Spring, spike in oil prices, the downgrading of U.S. debt, the pig crisis. I mean, those were pretty traumatic events that occurred, but the economy was growing at over 2% a year. So when the economy is growing, it acts as a shock absorber for these external events, these exogenous events that sometimes you just don't know where they're going to come from. Now we're down to 1%. And basically, the shock absorbers in the economy are getting thin. So what we're going to do in this section is we're going to dive into the weeds, because there's just a preponderance of different clues at the margin that say there's something happening here. And that's why you're probably hearing people like former Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, the IMF, Christine Lagarde, saying to the G20 countries, you better do something here. You better do something with fiscal spending, because we are decelerating. It's happening all across the globe, whether it's in England. The Bank of England cut interest rates a quarter of a point, John, and they were only at 0.5%, the same where the U.S. is. And I think, like my friend Gary Schilling, it's likely, if this continues, this trend continues, the Fed is likely to start changing its tune and talk about cutting. But we don't have the cushion. Now, getting into the economy, one of the big things that has been happening is inventories of businesses have been down 5 consecutive quarters in a row. And the reason that's a bad sign is, think about it. You have a business, you manufacture goods, and you keep them in the warehouse because you want to have all the items you need to sell that your customers want to buy. Well, if you have a warehouse and your sales are declining, or you're not moving your sales, what you're going to do is you're going to cut back on production, which is why we've seen the ISM PMIs fluctuate, go into negative territory, go back into positive territory, and then decelerate again. So what businesses have been doing is they're saying, look, we're not going to ramp up when we can't even sell this stuff. We're going to draw down our inventories and get lean and mean, because it's a bad sign. When businesses are reducing inventory stockpiles, it means that they have too much stuff laying around the warehouse and it's not matching up with sales.
You know, Jim, but as you've pointed out, it's not just the economic numbers they're doing it, but businesses, they're pointing towards something going on, but businesses aren't investing either.
No, that was another big piece that came out in the GDP numbers, is fixed non-residential investments are decelerating. They're down 3 quarters in a row. So you can see there's trends here. 5 quarters of inventory liquidation. And why that's significant is what can drive an economy is when businesses ramp up and build up inventories. That's a sign to the market that businesses are seeing new orders come in, new sales come in. So they're going to build up their inventory so they'll meet the demand of the marketplace. So now we have fixed non-residential investment declining 3 quarters in a row. We have private inventories dropping 5 quarters in a row. Now, if there's one bright spot, and we don't know how long this will be, if there's one bright spot out there, it is consumer spending. About 3 quarters of the U.S. economy is made up of consumption. However, consumer spending is vulnerable. The problem is with the economy right now is you have a concentration of growth into a narrow range of drivers for this economy. And that is troubling because the economy becomes more vulnerable. The slower the economic pace, the more vulnerable the economy becomes to some kind of exogenous shock. The slower the economic pace, the more vulnerable it becomes because consumers are sensing this and you can see it. And in order to maintain spending, what consumers have been doing is they've been drawing down savings for two quarters in a row. So economists would argue, well, gosh, it's good. Consumers are spending money. But on the other hand, they're draining their savings in order to maintain that consumption. And we all know that everybody's feeling nervous, which is, you know, going back to that lyric from Buffalo Springfield, there's something happening here. And it's also, you're seeing it reflect globally in elections. And it's amazing because you've got a populist movement. And sometimes with populism, you don't know how it's going to end. You have a theocratic dictatorship forming in Turkey. So you're going to have another superpower theocracy in the Middle East, a power that confront Iran. So you have now two powers that are developing in that area. So you have geopolitical risks and a number of other things. But, you know, this is what happens towards the end of an economic recovery. Fewer sectors of the economy begin to participate or are growing and participating. And that is always the signpost of, are we heading into a recession? And what we don't know, John, at this point is where we'll be next year with the new president. In other words, the next president could, whether it's Trump or Hillary Clinton, it's looking more likely like Hillary Clinton right now, that they come in with a big stimulus package, much like President Obama did in 2009, which could postpone the day of reckoning. We simply have no idea. But we do know both candidates, as we talked on previous programs, are talking about helicopter drops.
But you know, Jim, the consumers seem to be feeling good right now. Housing prices are up. Look at that. Things are bustling right along. Auto prices looking pretty good. So at least in that era.
Well, you know, there's once again some new information that we're starting to see a trend. GM, Ford, and Toyota all reported recently weaker sales. And the thing that you're starting to see come into the showrooms, which is something you see towards the end of a cycle. I mean, most people, I don't know what it's like where you are, John. You drive around here in California and you see a lot of new cars in parking lots. So a lot of people have upgraded their cars with the cheap financing of lease financing and also auto rates being at record lows because of record low interest rates, similar to what we're seeing in home mortgages. But now you're starting to see the resetting of incentives. So in other words, you know, if you want to push the cars out of the showroom, you better make it attractive. You know, they're throwing in extras, they're discounting all kinds of things because showroom sales are currently a trouble spot. I mean, fleet sales for companies are still strong, but in auto showrooms, it's starting to weaken. And analysts are taking a look at this and they're saying, well, can this continue? Probably not. Auto sales have probably peaked, but they could stay elevated, providing two caveats. And this is the one thing that you kind of question what the heck the Fed is doing right now. Keep talking about raising interest rates, as I talked with Mark Chandler in the first hour, is that for auto sales to continue, it's going to be dependent on two things. Robust sales incentives. In other words, they're going to have to start discounting, and they're already doing it. They're going to start throwing in, you know, maybe they throw in all the extras that you want to get on a car. You know what it's like when you're buying a car. The base price of the car is X, but if you get a car that has options like electric windows or who knows, whatever other options that are available, depending on what you're buying, you know, those cost extra. So those options are becoming free now. They're giving those options away. The second thing that needs to take place is cheap credit. And then the third thing that needs to take place is gasoline prices need to remain low. Because for a vast majority of Americans, if the price of gasoline was to go up 25 cents, 50 cents a gallon, that becomes a significant factor in spending. So this is becoming, even for auto companies, a more competitive market and a slowdown. And this is what you typically see in the peak of a business cycle. Auto sales peak. And what car companies do, they're still geared up for manufacturing a lot of cars, But now, however, to move the cars off the showroom, they have to start discounting. They have to start offering special deals. So if you're out there listening to this program and you haven't bought a car, well, just wait in the next 3 months and see what's going to come your way, because you're going to start seeing a lot more attractive options when it comes to buying an automobile as dealers start resorting to even special financing, you know, 0% financing. You remember that, John, coming out of the recession of 2009, you could get 0% financing when you were trying to buy a car. So it's going to become a more competitive market. The good news for you, the consumer, if you're thinking of buying a new car, they're going to get even cheaper.
But, you know, getting back to the whole idea of the economy and the numbers there, you know, okay, true, the LEIs are mixed, the PMIs are mixed. But overall, if you look at all of the components of the economy, we seem to be okay. And as long as the consumer is in good shape, and that represents about 70% of the whole picture, then everything should continue puttering along, at least for a while.
Well, I mean, theoretically, that could probably happen. It's one of the reasons why we're only cruising along at 1%, because, you know, the consumer is the main cylinder driving the economy right now. If you look at how they compute GDP, it starts out with consumption. That's you and I, the consumer. Investment, that's businesses investing in plant and equipment, building new factories, building new plants, new buildings, and government spending, plus what we do in exports. Now, the export figure is exports minus imports. And unfortunately, on the export sector, there's bad news there. Even though it picked up a little bit in the second quarter when the dollar fell from the first quarter of the year, the trade gap in the month of June accelerated up 8.7%. It really surprised everybody. It was a little over $44 billion. A lot of that was the surge in oil prices. But what happens is when the trade deficit goes up, it subtracts from GDP. So let's go back to the formula, consumption. So if 70% of the economy is consumption, that's you and I as consumers, if we're buying stuff made overseas, that's not helping companies here. If we were to have a closed market, if everything you had to buy was only made in the USA, then we wouldn't have a problem. But when you spend your consumer dollars and you buy a car, if you buy a foreign car, well, you're helping a foreign manufacturer. If you buy a good that is made overseas by a foreign company, you're helping them. So what happens is when you spend money on imports, it's not helping our economy. It subtracts from the economy, and that translates into slower economic growth. So here's another factor that we have. So if you take a look at these trends, John, the economy has been decelerating since the second quarter of last year. If you take a look at non-residential investment, that has been declining. If you take a look at auto sales, they have peaked and are now in decline, with companies having to restate incentives to move merchandise out the door. And now you also have imports that are rising. So yes, consumers are still spending money, but a lot of that money is being spent on foreign goods, which doesn't help it here.
Okay, well, you know, if you look at what happened last week, we had some real terrible news on the economy when the GDP came in a lot lower than projected. But this Friday, we had some good news. I mean, there's positive side. Unemployment seems to be holding at 4% steady, and an additional 255,000 jobs were created.
Well, I mean, on the surface, John, it would look good. But, you know, even then, if we just look at the general numbers, once again, we're looking for trend factors here to paint a bigger picture in terms of what we're actually looking at. And if you look at these trend factors, the economy added 255,000 jobs. That's the good news. But if you look at the broader trend, once again, we're not just looking at 1 month. Last year, the average rate of job creation was somewhere around 230,000 jobs a month. For 2016, it's dropped by almost 40,000. The average so far is 186,000. So the rate of job growth is decelerating as well. And that's what you're looking at. I mean, when somebody says, okay, we're in a recession, it's not something you're going to wake up one day and, you know, the first day of next month, we're in a recession. It is a process that takes place. Just like market tops are a process, market bottoms are a process. Same thing with recessions. Recessions and recoveries are a process. So we have a process or a trend that's taking place here. And the other factor here and you know, we've commented on this on the past, is these job numbers, if you take a look at them, one of the reasons why you're seeing this populist movement in the United States is people don't feel like an economic recovery. And that's because the real unemployment rate is probably closer to 11%. And my good friend Gary Schilling just did a piece in his recent newsletter. And he said that, you know, you take a look at the participation rate, the number of individuals that are actually going out, working in the workforce or looking for jobs has been declining. Now, as Gary talked about in his newsletter, about 60% of that can be accounted for baby boomers who are retiring and younger people who are staying in college longer. That's about 60% of that 4.6% improvement in the unemployment rate. And the other 40% is made of middle-aged people that have just basically said, you know what, I've given up. I've got my resumes out there. I'm on LinkedIn. I've done everything I can. I haven't been able to find a job. I can't work. You know what? Put my hands up. That's it. Might as well just stay on unemployment because I can't find work. So the problem that this creates is you hear the Fed, and they told us this in the economic recovery before they started raising interest rates when they first began to talk about it. They were going to watch what happened to the unemployment rate. And if you recall, going back to 2010, the number that they told the markets, hey, if we get down to a 6% unemployment rate, well, that's the number and we'll start raising rates. That would have been roughly around the end of 2013. Here we are at 4.9%. And I think one of the reasons is without these figures, either boomers retiring, millennials going to college, or simply people giving up on work, the unemployment rate would be closer to 11%. So the Fed is misreading the economic data. And this is one of the things that we talked about. We're going to talk on lifetime income. We're going into a completely whole new paradigm shift here economically and globally. So the drop in the unemployment rate is giving the Fed a false signal, because what we're seeing here is trend after trend. I don't care if it's the actual GDP numbers, if it's the actual job creation numbers, if it's the inventory drawdown numbers, if it's the business investment numbers, all of these are decelerating. So the economy is decelerating, job growth is decelerating, and despite the Fed's efforts to QE 1, 2, 3, inflation is below target. And the Fed is the only one out there that is still talking about raising interest rates. The two hawkish central banks in the world were the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve. And we saw what happened this week. The Bank of England, as a result of Brexit and what they're seeing happening in their economy, they lowered their equivalent of their Fed funds rate from 0.5% to 0.25%. And that's exactly where the Fed is right now. They're at 0.5%. And you know, according to my friend Gary Schilling, and I'm a subscriber to this view, the consensus seems to be right now, if they're not going to do anything in September because they have no clue how the markets are going to react to another quarter point hike, which surprised them when they went in December. So they have no clue what a quarter point would do before the election. So I don't think then. So everybody, the markets are seeing the higher probabilities. They'll wait to December, wait till the election, cruise by, give them a couple more months of numbers. And John, they got to be thinking and scratching their heads. Wait a minute. We've been talking about 2.5% growth rate. We only got 0.8% in the first quarter. We only got 1.2% in the second quarter. And they know that these numbers are subject to revision. So how confident can you really think? I mean, remember, most of these guys are academics. So given that, the only thing left in this economy right now, I mean, the Fed has got to be looking at these numbers. I mean, Jim Poplava or John Loeffler aren't the only people that are seeing this. There are a lot of smart guys on Wall Street. There are a lot of smart people in Washington that have got to be looking at these numbers, and especially the politicians, because no politician, the most important unemployment rate to a politician is their own jobs. And that's why nobody's talking about the things we're talking here, because nobody wants to take responsibility for the fact that this economy is decelerating.
Yeah, and what that comes down to, it leaves the last pillar in the whole equation, and that's the good old U.S. consumer.
You know, John, and even there's some troubling things that we're starting to see. One of the things that have happened in the last couple of weeks, and you always have this based on coming out of an earnings quarter, analysts are starting to downgrade the restaurant industry. Now, let me tell you why that's important. What are restaurant sales? Restaurant sales are discretionary income. When people have more money in their pocket, let's say from the drop in gasoline prices, they're getting, let's say, a cost of living increase at work, they're feeling secure about their jobs, they go out to eat. And if you take a look at the latest retail sales numbers, especially in the restaurant sector, traffic has been slowing down at all the major restaurants. Restaurant sales have been flat. The big chain stores are reporting slower sales, and fast food dining is down for the first time since 2004. Now, let me tell you why this is important. We already talked about the consumer makes up about 70% of the economy through consumption. So if you want to watch what's going through the minds of consumers, we saw one trend that we've seen since the beginning of the year. Consumers have been drawing down their savings to maintain consumption. Secondly, is the first area you start to cut back. If you're feeling nervous, you're going through your savings, well, maybe you start cutting back and you're not going out to dinner as often as you would normally go. And so that's why it starts to become significant. Now, if it happened 1 month, people would dismiss it. But in the last 6 months, restaurant sales have been declining three times. And why that's important is they were a leading indicator of recession 3 to 6 months prior to the beginning or onset of a recession in the last three recessions that we had. The recession of 2007, the one of 2001, and the one in 1991. Restaurant sales were key to each one of those recessions. So restaurants, John, really is the canary in the coal mine. And it's why some analysts see these weak restaurant sales portend something about the economy.
Well, you have to ask then, Jim, what's driving this whole thing? Because the unemployment rate is down, housing is up, stock is up. The conventions were telling us everything's okay. And yet what you're saying on the other side is all the indicators are indicating we're on a 6 month countdown to another recession. So what's driving all of this?
I mean, you know, one thing that we've talked about here on numerous occasions is markets hate uncertainty. Well, what are markets? The stock market is a collection of individuals. It's people. So if the market hates uncertainty, really what it's saying is people hate uncertainty. And if you take a look at the things that are going on right now, the uncertainty of a political election year. This isn't your standard political election, John. I don't know about you, but I've never seen an election like this in my entire lifetime. We've got terrorism. Do you realize that every 72 hours there is a terrorist attack in Europe now, including the woman that was just knifed, American citizen that was on vacation in a British museum? We have social unrest. Look at Black Lives Matter. Look what's happening to police officers, geopolitics, what's going on in Turkey, what's going on in the Middle East. Now you have economic uncertainty. So when times get tough, when people sense that there's something wrong here, and that's why I love that line to Buffalo Springfield, there's something happening here and it isn't exactly clear. And a lot of people are scratching their head and they're saying, you know, I don't feel like this has been an economic recovery. It certainly hasn't impacted me. You're seeing it reflected on television every night. When times get tough, eating out is the first thing that goes in the budget. And what we've seen is restaurant sales are down 3 out of the last 6 months. And if we look at those last three recessions, 1991, 2000, and 2007, when that trend continued, it was immediately followed by recession. So what analysts are saying is the slowdown that we're seeing in 2016 portends a possible recession in 2017, because it's not going to happen overnight. It's a gradual process that's taking place. And we're seeing all of these things take place on the margin. And the worst thing that is going on now with restaurants is the minimum wage. If your costs go up 50% because of government mandate, what are you going to do? You're going to automate more positions. As we talked a couple programs ago, how a lot of these fast food restaurants now are starting to go to automation, kiosk. They're getting rid of employees, and restaurants operate on a very thin margin, very low profit. So increase their labor costs, you decrease consumption. So, John, as I look at this with restaurant sales, why I'm paying a lot of attention to that, because what is the one bright spot in the economy right now is consumption, consumer spending. And right now, this is a canary that has started to sing.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Joining us on the show today is Cliff Droke. He's the editor of the Momentum Strategies Report, which covers the broad equity markets, and he's also the author of a few dozen books. The most recent one is Mastering Moving Averages. And Cliff, there's three main legs on the market stool and how we can analyze the market, as we usually refer to here on Financial Sense. And the first leg being often fundamentals. That's what a lot of people look at in terms of economic data. Then there's the technicals, what we see with investor sentiment, momentum, and the like. And then there's also the political leg as well. That's the third leg. And that has mostly to do with fiscal and monetary policy and how that drives movements in the market. Today, I want to focus with you on the technical leg when we look at the markets, because I know that is definitely one of your key areas of focus, as you are the editor of the Momentum Strategies Report, as I mentioned earlier. So if you wouldn't mind, can you give our listeners some important charts and technical indicators that you're watching that you think are really giving the investor community a proper signal of where you think that some of these technical indicators are giving for the sustainability of this current rally to new all-time record highs?
Well, Chris, this has been a really good time for the bulls since February. And it's ironic because it's the exact opposite of what we saw a year ago. Last summer, the stock market technicals or the internal indicators were deteriorating, and they seemed to be getting worse and worse. And of course, it led eventually to that collapse or mini collapse we saw later in the year. This time around, despite the fact that bears are growling and they seem to think that another big, huge decline is on the horizon, the indicators don't really show that. And the indicator that I'm watching right now, the one I really, since last year, has called the market both up and down, are the new 52-week highs and lows on the NYSE. That is simply the number of stocks making 52-week price highs or price lows. What we see with the new highs, new lows is there is, and has been since February, a complete lack of internal selling pressure. And you can define that by how many stocks are making new lows. If the number is below 40, that is on a daily basis, that there are fewer than 40 stocks making new lows, we can say that the market is internally healthy. And in fact, for the last few months, the number of new lows has in many cases been 10 or fewer, certainly not much more than that. And that tells us that there's really no urgency among the insiders, the smart money guys, to be selling stocks, you know, or on the up and up. And moreover, new highs have been expanding, which means that the demand for equities has also been rising. So from strictly a supply and demand standpoint, you can see that this market has a positive underpinning. As of right now, I don't see any, you know, unlike last summer, the situation, it's not an unhealthy one.
There is one thing that we have frequently pointed out here on the program. Welcome back to the next part of the big picture. And that is that what we're looking at is, I don't know what you, whether you call it a paradigm shift or in reality, something we haven't seen in 5,000 years here, because we're looking at the lowest interest rates in recorded history. And this is different. I mean, the whole environment is different. And there doesn't seem to be a grappling on the part of people with the fact that this really is a major paradigm shift from what was the old normal. Now, we've also discussed financial repression here on the program. And you have to look at the fact that Europe and Japan are going into negative rates. We may be doing it here, but all of this constitutes the reason for, I think we're out in uncharted territory to some degree.
We really are, because it's not just that we're witnessing the lowest interest rates in recorded history. John, we have never had negative interest rates in history. I mean, there's been negative real rates. Let me explain this for our listeners that may not be familiar with this term. You take the interest rate, let's say the interest rate is 5%, and let's say inflation is running at 3%, then the real rate of interest is 2%, because 3% of the 5% is for inflation. So there have been times when inflation has been above the average interest rate, and that would give you a negative interest rate. But we've never had actual negative interest rates like we have today, where, for example, 2 weeks ago, Germany auctioned off a 10-year German bond at a negative interest rate, meaning that you pay the government to loan them money. This is the first time that this has ever happened in history. And it's creating all kinds of distortions in the marketplace, as we're seeing. And basically, John, financial repression has gone global. It's not just the U.S. that has repressing interest rates, and there's all kinds of reasons that they're doing this through regulation. Because in order for financial repression to work, you've got to use regulations. So you take a look at Dodd-Frank and what the government has done. They're requiring a lot of institutions, mainly banks, to keep and buy U.S. Treasury debt, which is meaning they're forced to be buying these bonds that the Treasury is issuing at the lowest interest rates in the U.S. history. The same thing that they're doing is we'll get into in money market funds. They've changed the laws that makes it more favorable for money market funds to own treasuries. And so a treasury market fund that buys government debt operates on a different set of laws than one that goes out into the private sector. The problem that this is creating is, believe it or not, folks, one thing that's keeping this dollar strong, there is a shortage of dollars in the world today. And the other thing that is happening around the globe is the financial stress indicators are flashing, not quite red, maybe yellow, but they're no longer green. So the financial system is saying something is amiss here. And the problem is governments are absorbing a massive amount of savings through the issuance of debt. And what that's done is it's shifting where dollars flow into. If you do it through regulation, or you do it because people don't feel secure. And every time you get a crisis, as we did at the beginning of the year, everybody was worried about Chinese growth. What happens with Brexit? There's a flood of money that rushes out of one asset class and rushes into treasuries. And so it's not just the Fed. The Fed has not had to lower interest rates. The markets are lowering interest rates for the Fed, because we've seen treasury yields get down to 1.5% a couple of weeks ago. They were down to 1.36%. And there are some that believe that we could be heading down to 1%. If the economy starts to slow down, we head into a recession. What do you think the Fed's going to do? They're going to end up doing exactly what the Bank of England did this week, which is cut their Fed funds rate from basically 50 basis points down to 25 basis points. So that's why there's all this money that is going into treasuries that is driving the yield down. I don't care, all across the board. Yes, you could probably get a 3-month T-bill at 25 basis points. That's because the Fed funds rate was raised a quarter of a point. But it's creating all kinds of distortions in the market, and it's forcing people to do things they don't realize in terms of what they're doing may end up hurting them in the long run in terms of major losses.
You know, something there caught my interest. You were talking about money market funds and changes in the law. Elaborate on that a bit, would you?
Well, if you're a money market fund, this was put into effect. The directive came from the Fed, the SEC. Basically, money market funds, everybody knows you keep your money in a money market fund. If you put $10 in, you can pull out $10. So money market funds have never broke the buck. The only time they came close to doing that was in the financial crisis in 2008, and it took the Federal Reserve jumping into the system, backstopping money market funds because they were hemorrhaging with losses and they couldn't maintain the buck. So anticipating that we were going to have another financial crisis, and also to basically enhance in corral money into government securities through financial repression. They changed the laws. So if you're a regular money market fund, and pay attention to this, if you have your money and you have large amounts of money in a money market fund, I want you to listen to this. You could be in a situation where you find you cannot get access to your money if we have another financial crisis. Or number two, if you do get access to your money, you don't get all of it back. In other words, if you put in a buck, you may only get back 99 cents, 98 cents, 97 cents, 95. Who knows how bad the crisis is? So that applies to regular money market funds. However, the government has created an exemption from those rules if you are a treasury money market fund. In other words, you buy short-term government paper, one-year treasury bills, two-year treasury notes, short-term paper. So you are exempt from those kind of rules because money funds, theoretically, buy government paper, they're exempt. Treasury bills are easy to sell. There's no risk of default versus, let's say, commercial paper or, let's say, short-term debt issued by a corporation. As we saw in the crisis of 2008, the commercial paper market basically locked up. It froze. You couldn't get financing unless the Fed came to the rescue in the way they did. I remember I got an email in 2008, and this was in the midst where, you know, every single Monday there was a new crisis. Everybody remembered Hank Paulson going on TV and Dow dropping 500 points after every speech. I got an email from a listener to the program, and he was a produce broker in Northern California. And the way he works is he would buy lettuce from, let's say, Farmer John or zucchini from somebody else. And then what he would do is he would buy that and he would finance it in the commercial paper market. And then what he would do is sell it to the grocery stores. And the way the cycle works with billing, he would get paid in 90 days. And what he was basically saying is if they don't unlock this commercial paper market, we're going to start seeing food disappearing in the stores. So the government recognized that the Fed came to the backstop and eventually the commercial paper began to work. They unclogged the system, but we were in a very precarious situation during that period of time. So now there's two kinds of money market funds. There's a money market fund that invests in treasuries, which means you put in a buck, you're going to get a buck. Then there's the other kind of money market funds that don't invest in treasuries. And guess what, folks? They pay more interest. So if you're in a high paying interest money market fund, you better check, because if it's not treasuries, if we get into another financial crisis, you may not get a buck back. In fact, they may charge you penalties. Or if they have to liquidate assets at less than what they paid for them, you could get back less than what you put in. But part of this, John, is corralling money. It's another way that financial repression works, is you cut down the options for players to go elsewhere. It kind of keeps money flowing into the treasury market. What does that do? It drives down interest rates. Driving down interest rates, who's the number one beneficiary of financial repression? It's the government.
We talk about driving interest rates to negative territory. And as I said, this is being out somewhere where nobody's ever been before in the history of the world that we don't know. But as they do this, there are a number of effects, whether they're intended or not. Number one, it really destroys things for people who are trying to save. They have to be more creative in what they're doing. But also, I would think they're distorting the markets, because the markets at this point then stop operating on the fundamentals and they begin operating on guesses and reactions to what governments are actually doing, which is abnormal because it's not really related to the reality of market pressures. And maybe this is just an idea. Maybe that's why the forecasts are just so far off, because things aren't working under the normal rules.
Well, it is. I mean, governments across the developed world are really interfering with the private flow of funds and how investment decisions are made. I mean, we spend what, John, the last 7 years that we've been doing this program since the recovery began in the summer of 2009, what are we talking about? We're talking about what the government's doing, whether it's the stimulus package, whether it's the debt ceiling debate, whether it's the Fed QE1, QE2, the taper tantrum. Are they going to raise? Are they not going to raise? This is what we're talking about. We're not talking about the real fundamentals. What are companies' real earnings? What is happening to top-line sales? What are the drivers of the economy? These are the things that we're not talking about that you would normally look at when you're analyzing where the economy is going to go. It's more on taking a look at liquidity flows. So everybody was surprised after Brexit. We got a two-day drop where the Dow lost about 1,000 points. And then since then, it has been one record after another, both in the Dow, the S&P. And you have to ask yourself, what is causing this? It's liquidity. It's money flows. It's not the economy, because the economy is decelerating. And it's certainly decelerating not only here, in several parts of the world, the G20, we're actually in a recession. So it's not the economy and it's not corporate earnings, which have been declining for five consecutive quarters, and they'll probably do that in Q3. So what we do is you got to watch fund flows. It's one of the reasons we got really bullish on stocks in 2012. If you've been listening to this program, you know our view on dividend paying stocks, a view we still hold today in this kind of market. I mean, you can get 1.5% on a treasury. You can get twice that and sometimes three times that if you're going into dividend paying stocks. So this is how we're measuring things. This is how we're analyzing things. It's how money flows are happening. And after Brexit, I mean, the Bank of England made 250 billion pounds available of credit. They just cut interest rates. And on top of that, they're going to start buying corporate bonds. And on top of that, they're going to make negative interest rates to a bank. In other words, they're going to go to a bank and say, hey, if you want to loan John Doe some money and charge them 3%, we're going to give you the money at a negative interest rate. In other words, we're going to pay you, the bank, to loan John the money. So in addition to the money that you're going to earn on interest that you charge John, we're also going to pay you interest. So, I mean, we're seeing things that are distorting the marketplace as a result of financial repressions. The problem is, it's also creating liquidity issues for many individuals. I mean, why are they resorting to corporate bonds? It's because they're running out of government bonds. I mean, in Japan, the Bank of Japan owns 1/3 of all outstanding Japanese bonds. Take a look at the Fed's balance sheet, grown by $4 trillion of buying treasuries. So it is zapping liquidity in the marketplace. And that's why it doesn't take much to move the bond markets in either direction today, because that liquidity, they restricted banks in terms of market makers. A lot of banks have disbanded their treasury trading. There are a couple primary treasury dealers that are getting out of the market. And what that's doing is it's concentrating more and more of the trading in fewer hands, and it's actually cutting back on liquidity. And you take a look at a lot of these bond funds, and a word of caution to you, the investor that's out there that is trying to look for, you know, maybe you're retired or you're a pension fund or you're looking for places to put your money. A lot of these higher paying funds, from Vanguard to many of the others, have money invested in bonds in the corporate area that are illiquid. In other words, they couldn't get rid of them within 7 days. And that is the real danger. It's one of the reasons we like individual bonds and short-term bonds, is I don't have to panic. If I have a bond that's coming due at the end of the year or coming due next year, I can just sit on that bond and it'll come due. But if you're a bond fund and you're sitting on something and you get a liquidation notice, I don't care if you're an ETF, and clients want their money, you're going to be forced to liquidate those bonds. And if you're forced to liquidate when there's no buyers, you know what happens to the price? The price keeps dropping until you find a buyer. And sometimes when you get in these kind of markets, as we were in 2008, you don't know what kind of market you're going to be facing. So there's a problem with these negative rates in QE. Number one, they're not working, which is why I think next year, and especially if we head into a recession or we get another negative quarter of GDP growth, is that we're going to have helicopter drops. And that is where the government spends the money, and basically the Fed or a central bank comes in to mop it up and they pay for it.
Okay, Jim, but now we're talking about risk here. And if we look at the reaction to the Brexit and what happened in the beginning of the year as far as yields are concerned, yields can potentially be heading a lot lower.
Oh, absolutely. And we see that, because the one thing about the United States is it's the most liquid largest market in the world. It's the largest economy in the world. And where do people go when they need to park? Where do people go when they get scared? Where do people go when they want liquidity? I mean, you know, what do you do if you're a corporation? You're Apple. You're sitting on $200 billion in cash. You're going to put that in the local bank? You're not going to be able to do it. They couldn't absorb it. So you have to find money like treasuries and put your money in T-bills because you may need that cash. Maybe you're going to buy out another company. You're going to pay for it in cash, or you need it to build new plant or equipment. So it's a market that, as a result of, and you got to remember, as low as it is here, understand that one third of the world's sovereign debt is negative. It's worse in Europe. It's worse in Japan. It's worse elsewhere. And so anytime things get worse over there, that money finds its way into the United States. So in many ways, you can say the Fed has already begun to lower interest rates because that's exactly what has happened. I mean, we started over a year ago, we were at over 2.5% in 10-year treasuries. Here we are a year later, we're at 1.5%, we're 1 percentage point lower. And some of the best performing investments have actually been long-term treasury bonds, zero coupon bonds, 30-year bonds, 20-year treasury bonds, because when interest rates drop as much as they have, the price of treasuries go up in value. You can make 10, 15, 20% if treasuries go up. And there's some, like my friend Gary Schilling, who's been one of the best interest rate forecasters. This was a guy back in 1981, wrote a book on deflation, Ready or Not. And when treasuries are at 15.5, bet the farm on treasuries and felt that treasuries would get down to 3%. When they got down to 3%, he said, you know what? Next up may be 1%. So they can go lower because it's the largest liquid market in the world. Number two, what makes treasuries real popular with especially institutions is they're not callable. In other words, if you buy a 10-year treasury note, you can hold that treasury for 10 years. That's not the same. One of the problems that you're seeing in the corporate bond market is as these rates have drifted lower, a lot of those bonds out there are being called back because corporations are saying, gosh, we issued you a bond at 4.5%. Today, we can call that bond back and get a bond out there at less than 3%. The average yield on high-grade corporate debt is 2.75%. So imagine if you're a company that issued bonds at 4.5%, a couple of years ago, a lot of those bonds are being called. That can't happen in the treasury market. You own a 2-year note, you got it for 2 years. 5-year note, 20-year bond, doesn't matter. They're non-callable. And the other thing is, it's considered the highest quality debt in the world today. So, John, they can actually go lower. And the problem is, with all this quantitative easing that you're seeing, is there's actually a shortage of sovereigns in the world. And it's taken place as a number, like in the United States, it's a result of a drop in deficits. And QE created a lot of shortages, which is why you just saw the Bank of England this week announce that they're going to corporates, just as they're doing it in Europe and they're doing it in Japan, because there's just not enough quality sovereign debt out there. So, you know, in my opinion, none of this stuff has worked. And I think eventually we're going to be heading to helicopter drops. And the lesson to be learned here, when we start heading to helicopter drops, what's the definition of inflation is too much money chasing too few goods. And if the government puts enough helicopter money into the marketplace to stimulate the economy, the next direction of interest rates will be on an upward swing. And it's going to be more dramatic when you've got rates this low. I mean, you don't think about it, but if interest rates go from 1% to 2%, that's 100% movement in the change in bond yields, and it's going to be impactive. So that's why, John, this is, as Bill Gross gave a talk, and in fact, in his recent missive that he still writes, he's talking about he doesn't like yields here. You're not being compensated for risk. And he said when the reversal comes, it is going to be a very painful lesson for investors, and I would suggest you heed his advice.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Joining us on the show today is Worth Ray. He's the Chief Economist and Global Macro Strategist at STA Wealth Management. And Worth, we saw a pretty weak number come out for the second quarter U.S. GDP. It was about half of what most economists expected. However, in the aggregate, I would say economic data for the U.S. has been surprising to the upside. And we know that because we look at the Citigroup Economic Surprise Index, which has broken out now above the zero line where it's been really for over a year, for quite a long time. I think as long as they've been tracking economic surprises. So we now see economic data surprising to the upside. I guess the question now is, do you think that we are seeing a legitimate, genuine growth pickup in the U.S., or is this really just a reflection of economists perhaps getting way too pessimistic? What's your take?
I think that's a good question, Chris. You know, you hit on something I think really important that, you know, the Citi Economic Surprise Index has been ticking up for, you know, the past couple of months. We've seen it, you know, drop a little bit here recently with the durable goods number and with GDP. But, you know, we've had kind of positive momentum with the economy doing a little bit better. Now, I should say a little bit better relative to expectations, right? I mean, we're still in this kind of long-term structural slowdown. You know, year-over-year GDP growth has decelerated, you know, kind of a dismal, you know, 1.2% over, you know, a three-year period running kind of around 2%. So that's remarkably weak. You know, with all the stimulus, with all the QE and earlier in the cycle with all the fiscal support, you know, we still haven't seen this economy go above, you know, 3% year over year in the course of this expansion. It's been dismal to say the least. So I think there is, you know, quite a drag on growth. I think the labor market is getting pretty near full employment that hasn't already really gotten there, to be honest. And I think that, you know, this growth number is not a lot to shake a stick at. But what I should say here is that, you know, if you kind of look beneath the surface, this GDP report really isn't as bad as a lot of people make it out to be. So, you know, you had a pretty strong drag from inventory adjustment, which is much bigger than any inventory adjustment we've seen in recent quarters. And also, you know, fixed business investment, you know, has now been dragging on growth for the last three quarters. So that's, you know, not all that positive. But, you know, I should point out that an inventory adjustment actually does kind of decrease the risk of going into recession because you start to kind of bring that kind of excess down a bit. And that's a positive thing. But if you look at consumption, that's really the story of this GDP report. Consumption was fairly strong, all things considered. Almost 3%, you know, GDP growth on the consumption side. And we got a positive contribution from net exports that we haven't had in quite a while. So, you know, I kind of look at this and say, growth is weak. You haven't gotten clearly the kind of second quarter seasonal bounce back that you would expect. But if you look at the more recent data that's been coming in by a lot of measures, like you mentioned, you know, it looks like it is kind of continuing to muddle along and maybe improve a bit. So, you know, my assessment of the U.S. economy is that things are weak, that maybe they're improving on a seasonal basis, but we're still in this kind of late cycle slowdown. But, you know, that recent improvement does strengthen the argument for Fed hike expectations to come back. It, you know, kind of firms the dollar a little bit and allows, you know, foreign easing or events to send the dollar higher. And I think that leaves us particularly vulnerable to foreign shocks, which is why that foreign shock element is why I think that, you know, recession is possible this year and it's possible next year. But I don't think the U.S. economy is, you know, at risk of just rolling over on its own right now. At least I wouldn't handicap that as really high odds.
If you look at how well this particular investment did over the last 4 years, it's basically been flopping around and everyone's been saying, why isn't it doing better than that? We don't quite understand this. But now, Jim, you and some of your guests have been talking about one of this year's stellar investments, and it is sort of amazing. We're talking about it again. And we're talking about the precious metal gold. Gold doesn't have a PE ratio. It doesn't have interest rate or a dividend yield. So the real question is, why is everybody so bullish on it again when it doesn't have a return? What's driving gold? As a matter of fact, it would seem that the return is you simply hope the price goes up, which means you almost hope for some kind of disaster elsewhere.
Well, there are a number of things that drive gold, and what drives gold at any particular time depends on one of the various facets of gold's drivers. And the thing that people really don't understand, John, there could be six or seven drivers of gold, and any one of them could be operating at a particular point in a gold bull market. If you take a look at the low that was reached in gold in February this year, what really turned it around when the Bank of Japan went to negative interest rates. At the same time, the Fed was up on Capitol Hill, basically changing their rhetoric from where they were in December when they raised rates. And so it was off we go to the races. The other thing about gold, it's a very, very small asset class compared to the treasury market, sovereign bond market, or the stock market. So it doesn't take a lot of money to move into the gold sector to produce incredible rates of return, which is what we saw in some of the gold stocks this year. Some of them are up 200%. Some of the indexes up 100%. It's been one of those incredible performers. And one of the reasons, it's a very, very small sector. We've commented over and over with some of the guests that, you know, if you added up all the gold stocks added up together, it probably wouldn't even come close to approaching the market cap of Coca-Cola. So any kind of movement into the sector can cause the price of the precious metal to take off, or even the price of the stock. And one of the big movers has been movement into these gold ETFs. For example, GLD. There's $93 billion in gold ETFs. And if we take a look at the first quarter of the year, almost $14 billion moved into the gold ETF, representing almost 364 tons of the yellow metal. We haven't seen that happen since probably the first quarter of 2009. And you remember what the first quarter was like during the financial crisis. I mean, the price of gold this year is up over 25%. The gold stock's up 3 and 4 times that amount. Right now, demand for the ETFs, and remember, when that money flows into an ETF, they have to go in the market and buy gold with that money coming in. So there's all kinds of drivers, and right now it's money flows that are driving it. And what's driving the money flows more than anything else? It's negative interest rates, because gold competes with other asset classes. When we began QE in 2009, in 2010, gold really got a lift off, because when the Fed did QE1, gold rebounded. When they did QE2, it really took off. And that was that big run up to 1900, because the markets were saying, oh my God, they printed $1.2 trillion in QE1. That didn't do it. Now they're doing another QE. So the market was saying, you know, they're going to keep printing money. But eventually we got to a peak. And as interest rates began to come down, people were saying, look, you know, we can't go in the gold market. It's not big enough. Money began to shift and flow into other asset classes, especially stocks, which has happened and is still happening to this day. There's still money going into the stock market, especially at the institutional level. But there are a lot of drivers in this market. And one of the big drivers, as I mentioned, is fund flows into ETFs, fund flows into gold mutual funds. But if you take a look at the amount of gold that is basically traded, actual physical gold, it's about a little over 3,000 tons of gold. If you take a look at the supply of gold, it's about 10.5 tons physical gold. The ratio in the futures market, which is one of the big drivers, is almost 300 times the actual trading of the physical bullion. So at any point in time, and there's some, and this is a dream for many, is that in the futures market, if you buy a futures contract in gold, on $100, let's just make this easy mathematically, on a $100 contract, you put down $10. So you're leveraged. So your $10 can buy $100 of gold. The problem is most of the futures market is paper. It's traded on a daily basis. Very, very seldom do people that trade in the gold futures market demand delivery. There simply wouldn't be the gold to deliver to meet those contracts. In fact, if you read the fine print, it basically says in the case of emergency, they don't have to deliver the gold. They can simply deliver cash. In other words, instead of making a profit and owning physical gold, they'd simply pay you the price of gold in cash, which is not what you want. There's some that are speculating at some point there could be a short squeeze given the size of the futures market compared to the actual bullion market. And the futures market is really the daddy in the gold market, because what goes on with $93 billion in gold ETFs, yes, that's a lot of money, but it's nothing compared to what's traded on the futures market on a daily basis. So, John, there are a number of drivers for gold, and you never know at what part of the cycle what might start it, what might trigger it, what might maintain it, what might cause it to contract. A good example, the numbers that came out in GDP last Friday was positive for the gold market because people are saying, gosh, the economy only grew at 1%. That means the Fed is unlikely to raise interest rates. This Friday, we had a good number on the unemployment numbers. There were 255,000 jobs. Gold lost a little over $20 because people are thinking, oh my goodness, the job market is strong. That means the Fed can go, even though as Mark and I talked about in the first hour, there's only a 26% probability they go in September. And I just don't think they're going. And I really think whether they go in December, given the economic trends we talked in the first part of the big picture, even that is very iffy. But interest rates were a driver. If you sum it all up, and you never know what it's going to be, it's investment flows, which could be money going into ETFs, money going to gold mutual funds, money going to the futures market. It could be currency fluctuations, especially with Brexit, when gold took off with Brexit, because all of a sudden you have a depreciating currency. It could be inflation. It could be interest rates. When interest rates come down or go negative as they are today, that was the launch pad for gold in the beginning of this year. It could be, if you take a look at the gold bull market in the last decade, it's consumer spending. When you had double-digit economic growth in China and in Asia, the gold bull market in the last decade was driven by very, very strong consumption of gold. Another driver could be systemic risk. If people are worried about the collateral of their system and they worry about the soundness of the financial system, they want something that's tangible. So it could be systemic risk. So there are a number of factors, and at any point in time, either one of those can be a dominant factor. It could be the dollar, it could be interest rates, it could just simply be fund flows, geopolitical risk, political uncertainty. All of those factors go into the market, and I would be real leery if you ever have somebody tell you one thing that's going to drive gold. It never is one thing. It is multiple factors that drive the gold market.
Well, okay, so we talked about these distortions, but I would think that in the end, it still boils down to supply and demand.
Yeah, it does. And what we saw happen in the last decade is the price of gold went from $300 all the way up to 2011 when it got up to 1900. What happened is there were more companies that got into the mining business. For the first time, you had pure silver producers. You had gold companies that were buying other companies. There was a plethora of juniors out there that were doing exploration. And what happened is more supply came on to the marketplace. And then at some point in time, there will be enough supply. The same thing that we're seeing that's happened in the oil market. Everybody can remember when oil prices got up to $150 a barrel, what happened? We had the shale play, we had fracking, we had horizontal drilling, and we brought more supply and it drove the price down. So ultimately, it is a supply and demand game. But John, I don't care any one of these factors. If you look at currency fluctuations in the dollar, if you look at inflation, if you look at interest rates, if you look at systemic risk, all of those are gold positive currently. And the other one that is concomitant with that is investment flows. We're seeing it go into ETFs on a monthly basis, quarterly basis. We're seeing it in the futures market, although there's been a lot more short positions more recently than there have been long positions with the commercials. So there are a number of factors that drive it at one time. But I would say right now, gold has more things going in its favor given all these drivers. And at some point, all of these drivers will be operating at the same time, which is one reason why you've heard so many of the technicians on the program that are very bullish on gold, because it's broken out of its long-term downtrend, and that's significant. It tells you it's being accumulated.
You know, we got into the weeds on the program today about the economic numbers, and truly we are in an historic situation from interest rates and other ideas about how much this is all global that's happening right now. But also at the very, very same time, we're truly in an historic election year. Global events are becoming more and more strange, let's put it that way. And I don't know, altogether, that's where we are. So as we project forward, what do you think we're seeing?
Well, I think like anything else, these markets are shifting. They're moving on events that are being triggered by what's going on in government and central banks. I mean, today's drop in gold was based on the employment numbers, but as we got into it, those numbers in many ways are facts of fiction in terms of how they're being measured. So the key thing, John, is we're going to be paying attention to the economy. As we get into September, we'll begin the first of, I think, what is it, three presidential debates. People will start paying more attention to the polls, as will the market. As Tom McClellan commented on the program last week, there's, I don't know what it is about September and October, but at some point, the big boys will be back from their summer holidays. They're going to be looking at those economic numbers, and all of a sudden, you're going to see a portfolio shift heading into this fall, especially as the election campaign really gets into high gear 2 months before that final election. The markets will be paying attention, and the markets have been very accurate in predicting the winner about 96% of the time. So at some point, we will know before the actual election who the next president of the United States will be. So I would say economic numbers and the presidential election, outside exogenous events happening, which seem to be happening almost every single week. But right now, we've got the opening of the Olympics on Friday. Let's hope that they're safe this year. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.